on price or quality in the Japanese auto market, except a few novelty products, such as Cadillac limousines, the car of preference for Japanese gangsters, until they transferred their loyalties to Mercedes in the 1980s. Meanwhile, the Japanese companies received a windfall from North American and European quotas. When the Japanese were told they could sell only a fraction of the cars they had sold previously, they simply raised their prices until sales fell to the required level, and they reaped huge profits in the process. Indeed, the Western quotas are arguably the biggest public policy boost the Japanese auto industry has ever received, more useful than the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, ever was in Japan. The Japanese companies use their profits to wage a market share war in Japan, probably selling below cost in many cases and ensuring that Western importers would have little success selling there, even if there were no trade barriers at all. Then, in the late 1980s, the situation reversed. The Japanese companies used large profits from the booming domestic market, where the Japanese government did help by sharply reducing the commodity tax on car purchases, to underwrite their massive investments in production facilities in North America and Europe. They could move ahead without fear of U.S. producers filing suit that they were dumping or practicing other trade retaliation, because their profits were not used to sell cars abroad below Japanese prices. Instead, their profits were used for capital investments and new products, such as the Toyota Lexus LS400 and the Nissan Infiniti Q45, designed primarily for the U.S. and European markets. The U.S. and European companies, with no production presence in Japan, made some profits themselves in the strong Japanese market through a trickle of imports, but missed most of the opportunity. The failure to establish a manufacturing presence in Japan or elsewhere in East Asia, to seriously challenge Toyota, Nissan, and Honda in their home market and take away this rich profit load, is surely one of the West's worst competitive lapses. Managing the global enterprise. Given the overwhelming evidence that a multi-regional production presence is now essential for success in the motor vehicle industry, one question remains: how to manage a lean global enterprise consisting of three top-to-bottom production complexes in the 1990s, and perhaps several more in the 21st century. For instance, in India for the Southern Asia market, in Brazil and Argentina for the Latin American market, in Indonesia or Australia for the Oceanic market, and even in South Africa, if the present movement toward rejoining the world community continues, for the Southern Africa region. This is not a trivial management issue. Indeed, dynamic and effective management of global production organizations has largely defied the ingenuity of the automotive mass producers over nearly a century of trying. The first auto company to pursue a global manufacturing strategy was Ford. The present Ford Motor Company was founded in 1903 to manufacture the original Model A. By 1905, even though annual production still totaled less than 1,000 units, Henry Ford had established a Canadian manufacturing plant to assemble Ford cars for sale in Canada. In 1911, 3 years after the introduction of the Model T, Ford opened an assembly plant at Manchester in England. By 1926, Ford was operating assembly plants in 19 countries. However, these steps hardly constituted serious internationalization. Ford's primary motivations were to reduce shipping costs. Parts were cheaper to ship than finished units, and to surmount tariffs. Then, as now, these were usually higher on finished units than on parts. Henry Ford made clear that all design and as much component fabrication as possible were to be retained in Detroit. In addition, the foreign branch plants, as they were called, were almost always under the management of Americans sent from Detroit. This pattern continued throughout the 1920s. However, as one country after another erected trade barriers after the collapse of the world economy in 1929, Ford was forced to go further. He built a fully integrated manufacturing complex at Dagenham in England in 1931, and a similar, though smaller, complex at Cologne in the same year. By the mid-1930s, these plants were producing practically all the parts for Ford's products. Much more radical from Henry Ford's perspective, they manufactured a new product, the Model Y, not produced in the United States. This was Henry Ford's belated acknowledgement that Europeans did not want to drive American-style large cars. We must remember, however, that the Model Y was designed in Detroit, and many of the tools for its manufacture were made there as well. While English engineers suggested ways to accommodate the car to European tastes, the Model Y and all Ford products of the 1930s were practically 100% American-engineered. Only after the war did Ford of England and Ford of Germany begin to hire their own product development engineers, and not until 1961, with the introduction of the Ford Anglia, was a Ford product for the first time completely designed in a foreign country. This development occurred exactly 50 years after Ford began its European assembly operations at Trafford Park, Manchester. By this point, the Ford Motor Company had turned 180 degrees from its original practice, where Henry Ford had demanded 100% control of the product and ensured that all manufacturing decisions came from Detroit. Henry Ford II presided over a remarkable process of decentralization, in which the newly formed Ford of Europe shared no common products with Detroit. It had limited personnel transfers, that is, only a few Americans in senior positions. It was in many ways a totally separate company, in all respects, save financial. Because it recognized the emergence of a unified Western Europe before West German, French, or British companies did, becoming the first European company in Europe, Ford of Europe, established in 1967, became remarkably successful and was a key contributor to the survival of Ford in North America. Massive loans from Ford of Europe tided Ford over during the Great North American Auto Depression of 1980 to 1982. However, from the perspective of senior management in Detroit, the evolution of a largely decentralized company was far from ideal. By the 1970s, the company in North America had developed a wide range of products smaller than the standard size American car of the 1950s. Many of these cars were identical in overall dimension to the products developed separately by Ford of Europe. It seemed only logical that global standardization of products in each size class would produce enormous savings in development costs and manufacturing economies. Ford's first attempt to standardize on a global basis was the Escort, introduced in 1979. A world design team was designated to develop this car, with contributions from all of Ford's global operating companies. However, in the process, a curious thing happened. The Europeans from Ford of Europe and the Americans from North American automotive operations managed to specify change after change in this world car to accommodate, respectively, European and American tastes and manufacturing preferences. On launch day, the European and American Escorts, although practically indistinguishable in external appearance, shared only two parts, the ashtray and an instrument panel brace. In 1979, Ford bought a 25% stake in Mazda in Japan. Because Mazda also makes a full range of products from small to large, it seemed logical to integrate some of Mazda's products into the worldwide Ford product planning and development process. For a start, Ford established its own distribution channel in Japan, Autorama, and began selling restyled Mazda 121, 323, and 626 models there with Ford badges. These models are also sold as Fords in many markets in Southeast Asia. A bit later, Ford decided to import a restyled version of Mazda's small 121 design to the United States from Korea, where it is assembled by Kia, a small firm in which Ford and Mazda both hold a small equity stake. This model is sold under the name Ford Festiva. By the time the Ford-Mazda link was fully established, it was too late to consider a joint design exercise for Taurus/Sable, launched in 1985. But joint design was carried through on the new Mazda 323 and Ford Escort, launched in 1989 in Japan and in 1990 in the United States. A similar cross-regional exercise involving Ford of Europe and Ford North America, called CDW27, is now underway on the new Ford Tempo/Topaz for the North American market and the Ford Sierra replacement in Europe, due in 1991. Ford calls the process of joint design, with the lead role assigned to either Mazda at Hiroshima for 323/Escort, or Ford North America in Dearborn for the next generation of large cars to replace the Taurus/Sable, or Ford of Europe in the United Kingdom and Germany for Tempo/Sierra. Centers of responsibility. Senior executives in the company have advocated this approach as the only way to control spiraling development costs for new products at a time when a greater variety of cars and trucks is needed in every regional market. However, thus far, full implementation of centers of responsibility has eluded Ford's best efforts. Ford of Europe argued that the new 323/Escort was too small for Europe and has pushed ahead with its own design for launch at the same time. Similarly, in 1989, it introduced a new Fiesta model in the next smaller size class after rejecting use of the Mazda 121 design, which was judged too small. Finally, executives in Europe are resisting the inclusion of their large car, the Scorpio, in the Taurus/Sable replacement program on the ground that no single design can satisfy both American and European consumers in this class of car. What's more, Mazda, while happy to act as lead designer on the 323/Escort project, has continued to design its own models for other size and market classes, 121, Miata, 626, and 929. And these models continue to compete directly with Ford products in the major regional markets. It is sobering to realize that even with its limited progress in globalizing design and production, Ford is still the clear leader among all companies, including the Japanese, in establishing itself as a truly global organization, with design and production facilities in the three major markets. By contrast, Chrysler has only a tiny manufacturing presence outside North America, consisting of an agreement with Steyr in Austria to assemble 30,000 Chrysler vans each year, beginning in 1991. General Motors has a strong presence in Europe and Brazil, but continues to run these operations as decentralized, standalone companies that hardly talk to its North American operations. Finally, the European-owned companies have either never started the globalization process or, as we'll see in a moment, made only halting progress at a few locations in developing countries. The Japanese, by contrast, are now showing an intention to globalize after strong initial reluctance and have had some initial success. However, they face huge hurdles in the coming decade, as we will see in a moment. The European failure to gain a global presence. The European industry now trails the Americans and the Japanese in globalization. When we consider the experience of the Europeans, a fundamental axiom emerges. It is impossible to establish lean production on a global basis when you have not mastered it at home. The case of Volkswagen provides a good illustration. In 1974, Volkswagen established an American assembly plant at Westmoreland, Pennsylvania. Its objective was to establish a lower-cost American manufacturing base as the German mark appreciated and the Japanese producers stepped up their sales offensive in North America. However, Volkswagen knew nothing about lean production and staffed its U.S. plants with old-line manufacturing managers lured away from General Motors. The results were disastrous. For one, cost savings failed to materialize. Equally damaging, the product adjustments made for the American market caused quality to tumble while alienating buyers attracted to traditional German products. After 15 years of frustration, Volkswagen departed for Mexico in 1989, hoping that low wages there would provide the basis for reestablishing its historic position in the entry-level U.S. market. Renault suffered an even more costly disaster. It purchased American Motors in 1979 with the intention of obtaining a low-cost presence in North America. However, Renault also had no understanding of lean production and made little headway in revitalizing some of the worst mass-production plants in North America. In 1987, Renault had had enough. It sold out for a fraction of its purchase cost to Chrysler, which is belatedly attempting to reform these old facilities, in the first instance by closing the worst, such as the Kenosha, Wisconsin assembly plant built in 1905. We can appreciate the full cost of Renault's setback in the United States when we consider that the company now has no manufacturing presence outside France, Spain, and Portugal, three of the most protected markets in Europe, excepting a sole assembly plant in Belgium. Volkswagen at least retains a half interest in the Auto Latina operation in Brazil, owns an integrated manufacturing complex in Puebla, Mexico, and a small but troubled operation in Shanghai. If it could master lean production in manufacturing operations and product design, and transfer these techniques to its Brazilian, Mexican, and Chinese operations, its prospects might improve rapidly and dramatically. This is particularly so given its geopolitical advantage in establishing operations in Eastern Europe. Clearly, the first step for the European companies is to master lean production in all areas of manufacture, so they can defend their home region. Otherwise, the Japanese and, surprisingly, the Americans may be the only lean producers in post-1992 Europe. Ford has dramatically improved its manufacturing operations in Europe by transferring what it has learned from Mazda. Only when the Europeans master lean production methods will they be in a position to revitalize their manufacturing presence in North America and East Asia. By then, though, it may be too late. The Japanese and global presence. The Japanese begin from a better position, but face extraordinary global challenges as well. A brief look at Honda's strategy sheds considerable light on the problems ahead. As is so often the case, the company that takes the boldest leap in the world market is the one in the weakest position at home. While Americans have practically made Honda's a cult product, the company was perceived in Japan as a scrappy but somewhat eccentric minor player. Unlike Toyota, Nissan, Mitsubishi, and Mazda, Honda had no close links to a keiretsu and no major business activity other than cars and motorcycles. Completely atypical for Japanese companies, it also had little interest in the truck market, limiting its offerings to a single mini minivan. Given its overwhelming reliance on exports, which account for about 70% of its Japanese production, Honda decided by the mid-1970s that it would be necessary to produce abroad. Its vulnerability to currency shifts and trade barriers was simply too great if it didn't spread its manufacturing base. Its U.S. auto assembly plant opened in 1982, but was initially only an assembly operation, producing cars with perhaps 25% American manufacturing content versus 75% Japanese. At the same time, Honda was searching for a manufacturing base in Europe. This was much harder to develop because Honda started selling in Europe considerably after Toyota and Nissan, and even after Mitsubishi and Mazda. So it was last in the queue for for the quotas established on Japanese imports into Britain, France, and Italy by the early 1980s, and had a very weak distribution network in the more open markets, such as Germany. With European sales of only 140,000 units in 1989, spread between five models, Honda was in a weak position to move immediately to a full-size assembly operation. Instead, Honda pursued a stormy alliance with Rover Group, initially a state-owned company, but now part of private sector British Aerospace. After several licensing agreements in which Rover built Honda designs in England, this led to a collaboration on the design of the model that became the Honda / Acura Legend and the Rover Sterling. Honda planned to sell Legends produced at Rover's UK Cowley plant to bolster its sales volume in Europe. However, it reportedly found the cars of unacceptable quality, even after rework at a new Honda-owned plant at Swindon in western England. So it quietly discontinued this effort shortly after it began. The next step was to design and produce jointly a new midsize car, the Honda Concerto / Rover 200. In 1989, Honda took a 20% equity stake in Rover and provided a large amount of manufacturing assistance on the new Concerto / Rover assembled at Rover's Longbridge plant near Birmingham. The product was launched in Europe in late 1989 and will be followed in 1992 by a new joint product, the Syncro, produced at Honda's own assembly plant at Swindon, which Honda will open at that time. Honda has therefore moved painfully toward a European-based manufacturing system, whose final form is yet to emerge, through a complex collaboration with Rover. Meanwhile, in the United States and Canada, it has steadily expanded its assembly plants at Marysville and East Liberty, Ohio, and Alliston, Ontario. Capacity should reach 600,000 units by the end of 1990. Combined with its imports, Honda will probably pass Chrysler at this point to become number three in North American passenger car sales. Of greater interest for our purpose, Honda has steadily increased the North American content of its cars by adding a 500,000-unit engine plant at Anna, Ohio, and a host of wholly owned components operations nearby. It also obtains a wide range of components from traditional Honda suppliers from Japan who have opened American transplants nearby, and from established American-owned suppliers. While local content calculations are notoriously unreliable, Honda's claim that it will achieve 75% North American manufacturing value in its United States and Canadian assembled cars by 1992 is probably not far off the mark. Local content is simply the portion of the car made in the United States. For example, the engine made in Anna, Ohio is local, while the engine computer made in Japan is imported content. How companies can add engineering value is a much more interesting question when it comes to achieving global presence. Honda has taken the lead among the Japanese transplants in establishing an American engineering operation, both for products and manufacturing processes. What's more, Honda is already offering one model, the Accord Coupe, which is styled and tooled in America, has a second, the Accord Station Wagon, in preparation, and talks of designing and engineering products from the ground up in North America by the end of the 1990s. However, we shouldn't underestimate the scale of this task. Honda will have 700 engineers in Ohio and Michigan by 1991, seemingly a large number, until one remembers that Ford and GM employ tens of thousands of engineers in Detroit. Even taking into account our findings from Chapter 5, that Honda and other Japanese firms are likely to use engineers up to twice as efficiently as the Americans, Honda has a long way to go to implement top-to-bottom lean production in North America. This process took Ford 50 years in Europe. Honda is renowned for its ability to do things in a hurry, but we shouldn't underestimate the problems involved in developing a complete product development system on a new continent. Even if Honda can move very rapidly, we have to ask how the company's growing global operation will be managed. Honda's public answer is that it will build an alliance of self-reliant regional companies in Japan, North America, and Western Europe, and even in Latin America, Brazil, and Southeast Asia, Thailand. The major regional companies are to conduct top-to-bottom design, engineering, and manufacture of products. These are to be sold primarily in their region of manufacture. But limited volumes are also to be exported to other regions to serve niche markets. The Accord Coupe, now being exported from the United States to Japan, and soon to be exported to Europe as well, is the first example of this process. But how are the regions to coordinate their activities? What will a World Honda personnel system look like? Will the senior jobs at headquarters still be reserved for Japanese nationals joining the company at age 22? How long will it take to bring about the alliance of self-reliant regions? These are all questions Honda must answer if it is to succeed at becoming a truly global enterprise. Specifying the multi-regional enterprise. Ford and Honda, the two most advanced companies in building a multi-regional production system, have made considerable progress, although neither would claim it has yet found the perfect solution. By comparison, however, the Europeans and Chrysler in the United States haven't left the starting gate, and the rest of the Japanese, including Toyota, substantially trail Honda. Clearly, the world and the auto industry have a long way to go before multi-regional production is fully implemented. We'll consider this challenge from a political perspective in our final chapter. Here, we look at the management challenge these companies face by laying out the features of a truly global enterprise that can achieve multi-regional lean production in the 1990s. Our goal is to specify the ideal enterprise in much the way buyers of such craft-built cars as the Aston Martin used to specify the car of their dreams. Unfortunately, no such dream machine currently exists, so we will create it. Multi-Regional Motors, MRM. The management challenge, we believe, is simple in concept. To devise a form of enterprise that functions smoothly on a multi-regional basis and gains the advantage of close contact with local markets and the presence as an insider in each of the major regions. At the same time, it must benefit from access to systems for global production, supply, product development, technology acquisition, finance, and distribution. The central problem is people. How to reward and motivate thousands of individuals from many countries and cultures so that they work in harmony. Unfortunately, the three models developed so far for this enterprise are inadequate. The first is extreme centralization of decision-making at headquarters, a headquarters almost invariably located in the home country and staffed by nationals of the home country. As we've seen, this was Ford's approach from 1908 into the 1960s, and it is the approach of many Japanese companies moving offshore now. Centralization produces bad decision-making. Much worse, from a political standpoint, it generates intense resentment in other regions, as it soon becomes apparent that the most important decisions are always reserved for headquarters and for those employees with the right passport. The commonly pursued alternative has been extreme decentralization into regional subsidiaries, each developing its own products, manufacturing systems, and career ladders in isolation from the other regions. This was the position of Ford of Europe in the 1970s and still describes GM of Europe. This hermetic division by regions results in a narrow focus, ignores advantages of cross-regional integration, and creates gilded cages for highly paid national executives unable to rise any further in their organization. Strategic alliances with independent partner firms from each region, a variant on the last approach, is the third model. Examples include Mitsubishi with Chrysler, and General Motors with Isuzu and Suzuki. Indeed, Lee Iacocca has often talked of a Mitsubishi/Chrysler/European producer alliance, calling it Global Motors. Unfortunately, these arrangements leave the central question of coordination and overall management unanswered. Given this fact, it is hardly surprising that most strategic alliances in the motor industry, as differentiated from narrowly focused joint ventures such as NUMMI, with specific short-term objectives, have proved undynamic and unstable. The continuous bickering between Ford and Mazda, GM and Isuzu, and Chrysler and Mitsubishi suggest not that these arrangements need better management, but that they are unmanageable except in perfectly stable market conditions. In this vacuum of choices, let us propose a new corporate form we term the post-national. The key features of what we call multi-regional motors are as follows. An integrated global personnel system that promotes personnel from any country in the company as if nationality did not exist. Achieving this goal obviously will require great attention to learning languages and socialization, and a willingness on the part of younger personnel to work for much of their career outside their home country. However, we already see evidence that younger managers find career paths of this type attractive. We have met numerous Japanese managers at the U.S. transplants who look forward to long U.S. tours and to future assignments in Europe. Unlike older managers who often lack language skills, they see this path both as an interesting way to live and as the surest route to success in their company. Similarly, Ford of Europe has recently had considerable success in recruiting European managers who do not expect or want to work in their home country, and who anticipate serving for considerable periods in the United States as well. And we are now running across a number of Americans eager to work in Japan. A set of mechanisms for continuous horizontal information flow among manufacturing, supply systems, product development, technology acquisition, and distribution. The best way to put these mechanisms in place is to develop strong SHUSA-led teams for product development, which brings these skills together with a clear objective. In most Western companies, much activity is unfocused. Product planners work on products that never get the green light. Massive amounts of staff waste time fighting fires. The best Japanese companies, by contrast, believe strongly that if you aren't working directly on a product actually heading for the market, you aren't adding value. So involving as many employees as possible in development work and production is vital. Companies should keep their eyes on the product the consumer will buy. Teams would stay together for the life of the product, and team members would then be rotated to other product development teams, quite possibly in other regions and even in different specialties. For example, product planning, supplier coordination, marketing. In this way, the key mechanism of information flow would be employees themselves as they travel among technical specialties and across the regions of the company. Everyone would stay fresh, and a broad network of horizontal information channels would develop across the company. Teams in Japan do stay together now, but members aren't assigned to new projects in new regions as a way to create a global flow of horizontal knowledge and to give every employee a sophisticated understanding of the world. The question, of course, is not whether this is a good idea in principle, but whether enough employees would find it attractive. As they travel through the company and across regions, these managers also would create a uniform company culture, a largely implicit way of thinking and doing things that every organization needs to function well. A mechanism for coordinating the development of new products in each region and facilitating their sale as niche products in other regions, without producing lowest common denominator products. The logical way to accomplish this goal is to authorize each region to develop a full set of products for its regional market. Other regions may order these products for cross-shipment as niche products wherever demand warrants. Since MRM will ship products in roughly equal volumes among its regional markets, it can largely ignore currency shifts. Losses on cars shipped in one direction are offset by higher profits on cars sent in the other direction. When currencies shift today, management typically panics and explores ways to relocate production to low-cost areas quickly, or they search for trade protection. MRM's managers, who will have a long-term commitment to a world-class lean production system in each major region, can be much more relaxed, provided that one additional element of the post-national enterprise is in place: internationalized financing and equity. Most of today's motor vehicle companies have the bulk of their equity and borrowings in their home region and pay dividends and loans in their home currency. So shifts in currency values are still a problem, even if they have succeeded in establishing a multi-regional production system. Consider an American firm with dollar-based loans and dividends. A strengthening of the dollar could prove very damaging if the company earned the bulk of its profits offshore, even though the company's market position and profitability in local currency terms in all three regional markets was unchanged. Internationalizing corporate equity so that funds are raised in each region in rough correspondence with sales volume and manufacturing investment would largely eliminate this concern. Dividends could then be paid in the currency of the region to insulate the organization from currency shifts between regions. With these new approaches to personnel management, information flows, product development, cross-regional trade, and internationalized finance in place, it may be possible to create an MRM appropriate to the regional world of the 1990s. We believe it is particularly important that motor vehicle companies such as MRM come into being, not just for commercial reasons, but because of the emerging global political challenge. We will return to this point in the final chapter. Diffusing lean production. We have now gone through the elements of lean production in the factory, in product development, in the supply system, in the sales and service network, and the hypothesized multi-regional lean enterprise. Our conclusion is simple. Lean production is a superior way for humans to make things. It provides better products in wider variety at lower cost. Equally important, it provides more challenging and fulfilling work for employees at every level, from the factory to headquarters. It follows that the whole world should adopt lean production, and as quickly as possible. As with so much else, however, this is easier to say than to do. Whenever a fully developed set of institutions is firmly in place, as is the case with mass production, and a new set of ideas arises to challenge the existing order, the transition from one way of doing things to another is likely to prove quite painful. This is particularly true if the new ideas come from abroad and threaten the existence of major institutions in many countries. In this case, the massive home-owned, mass-production motor vehicle companies. With help from their governments, these institutions may resist change for decades, or even overwhelm the new way of thinking. So we are not certain that lean production will prevail. We do believe that the 1990s will tell the tale. We are convinced that the chances of lean production prevailing depend critically on a wide public understanding of its benefits and on prudent actions by old-fashioned mass producers, by the ascendant lean producers, and by governments everywhere. In the remaining chapters, we'll shift from analysis, what lean production is and where it came from, to prescription. We'll present a vision of how the world can make the transition to a new and better way of making things with a minimum amount of pain and tension. Chapter 9. Confusion about diffusion. Between 1914 and 1924, Henry Ford's and Alfred Sloan's industrial innovations destroyed a vigorous American industry, the craft-based motor vehicle business. During this period, the number of U.S. automobile companies fell from more than 100 to about a dozen, of which three, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, accounted for 90% of all sales. Yet there was no panic, no protest, no call for government intervention. True, a series of social critics questioned the new type of factory life that mass production was introducing, but no one called for the protection of the embattled craft producers. The reason for the lack of resistance is not far to seek. Even as Ford and Sloan were demolishing one industry, they were creating a second, the mass production motor industry, and they were doing it in the same city where craft production had flourished most vigorously. The growth of this second industry was so dramatic that practically all the skilled workers of the craft-based industry could find jobs building tools and doing other skilled tasks to support the mass production system. Indeed, until 1927, when Model T sales collapsed, Henry Ford faced the continual problem of finding enough skilled workers in the Detroit area to man his tool-making operations. Meanwhile, the rapid growth of car and truck sales, combined with continually falling prices, was creating hundreds of thousands of new unskilled jobs on the assembly line. In addition, Ford and Sloan were Americans, hometown boys even, and Henry Ford adroitly portrayed himself as a folk hero, bringing a high standard of living to the common man. There was no suggestion of foreign menace in the triumph of mass production in Detroit. No one has repeated Ford's and Sloan's ease in supplanting one type of production method with another. Indeed, as soon as mass production began to move abroad from the United States, it began to encounter resistance. This pattern is repeating itself today as lean production displaces mass production. The basic problem was and is that existing companies and workers using older production techniques find it hard to adopt new ways pioneered in other countries. The alternative method of diffusing new techniques, the arrival of foreign companies, tends quickly to set loose a nationalistic reaction in the countries where the old-style companies are based. The result has often been a delay of decades in substituting new production methods for old ones. Mass production encounters craft production in Britain. In October 1911, Henry Ford opened an auto assembly plant at Trafford Park near Manchester, England. With the exception of a small assembly plant in Windsor, Ontario, just across the Detroit River from his Highland Park plant, this was Ford's first venture abroad. Ford built the Trafford Park plant to overcome the limitations of the transport of the day, but soon he needed it to overcome trade barriers as well. In 1915, Britain had abandoned free trade and adopted the McKenna Tariff, which imposed a 25% tax on completed autos that came from abroad. Most of these imports came from the United States. Parts, by contrast, bore only a 10% tariff, so foreign manufacturers had a strong incentive to establish final assembly plants in England. Initially, everything went well at Trafford Park. Ford dispatched a large number of American managers from Detroit to replicate exactly the mass production system he was perfecting at Highland Park. When workers were hired, they were explicitly told that they would be handymen, that is, none of their craft skills, if they had them, would be needed, and they would be available to move from job to job in the assembly hall. Indeed, one manager at Trafford Park estimated that it took only 5 to 10 minutes to train a worker to do practically any of the assembly jobs in the plant. The first powered assembly line was installed in September 1914, about 9 months after the first powered line became a reality at Highland Park. By 1915, the full complement of Ford assembly technology and techniques was in place at Trafford Park. The implications of Ford's mass production system were not lost on the skilled workers Ford was hiring for the bodybuilding shop. The upholstery department, for example, used special molds to eliminate the skilled job of hand stuffing. Seat cover sewing was standardized and simplified. In the body shop, stamping presses eliminated the skilled panel beaters, whose descendants we recently encountered at Aston Martin. A paint spraying system substituted for the skills of the brush painter. The result in 1913 was a strike that closed the body shop, as skilled coach builders protested Ford's methods and argued for a return to skilled work paid by the traditional piece rate system. Ford had broken ranks with British employers and paid by the hour at Trafford Park, as he did in Detroit. Because workers doing simplified tasks on the production line could easily be replaced, and Ford, in any case, could supply finished car bodies from Detroit, the strike soon collapsed. It was more expensive to ship car bodies from Detroit. The British tariff and damage in transit drove costs up, but Ford could do so until the strikers exhausted their savings and gave in. By 1915, no one was challenging Ford's system in the plant, and a Ford manager from Detroit reported that productivity at Trafford Park was comparable to that at Highland Park. Seemingly, mass production had triumphed in a new setting. Logically, it should soon have become the dominant form of production in England and perhaps in Europe as well. However, this was not to prove the case. The reason was a series of events that make us very cautious about the rapid and easy triumph of lean production in the 1990s. The tribulations of mass production in Britain. Ford's problems began in 1915 with an improbable event, the mission of his peace ship. Ford was an ardent isolationist. The United States should stay out of the First World War, he protested. To that end, he organized a trip to Europe aboard a chartered ship to broker peace privately between Germany and Britain. In Britain, however, the public perception of Ford's motives was emphatically different from Ford's own statements. He was universally thought to be pro-German. The result was popular resistance to Ford products. Many newspapers, for example, refused to accept Ford's advertising, and a loss of morale among Ford's British employees. Energetic action by Ford's British managers offset some of the bad feeling, but Ford's problems soon multiplied. The energy and horsepower taxes enacted after the war were particularly hard on Ford products. The horsepower tax, in particular, which was proposed to the government by Ford's competitors, and which favored their long-stroke designs over Ford's short-stroke engine, proved a crippling blow. Ford's Model T, envisioned as the universal car, was soon the wrong car for Britain. The consequence of Ford's bad fortune was that his factory often ran at a fraction of its capacity, and the company back in Detroit seemed to lose interest in its performance. Not surprisingly, factory performance seemed to deteriorate steadily. None of the English managers shared a conception of management that was compatible with mass production. The idea of a manufacturing career beginning on the shop floor with hands-on management was unattractive to middle-class Englishmen who emerged from an educational system that steered them toward the civil service, the law, and other types of high-level administration. They didn't want to get involved with the nitty-gritty of running anything. Rather, they wanted to delegate operational details, just as they did with the empire. In addition, British managers were persuaded that Englishmen, with a long experience of craft working, would not tolerate Ford's methods. For a short period, perhaps, under the whip hand of the American managers, but certainly not over the long term. Consequently, managing the shop floor soon became, by default, the responsibility of the shop steward, who typically was a skilled craftsman highly suspicious of mass production. These frontline managers lobbied to retain traditional skills and piece rate payment systems, which made no sense in continuous flow production, where every worker's effort is paced by that of every other worker. The performance of Ford's English plants went backward to a point where an enormous gulf developed between practice in Detroit and in Trafford Park. When Ford abandoned Trafford Park and established a full-fledged top-to-bottom manufacturing system at Dagenham, England, in 1931, the gap became even greater. Moreover, it persists to this day. With the Ford Motor Company, the inventor of the new system and the industry leader, making such a poor showing, it's hardly surprising that Ford's English competitors embraced mass production with only partial success. Industrial Pilgrims, the trip to Highland Park. By the spring of 1914, Henry Ford was actually turning out two products at Highland Park, Model T's and refurbished Captains of Industry. An endless stream of industrial pilgrims began to arrive around 1911 in a flow that continued for 40 years. Indeed, the pilgrimages ended only with the visit of A.G. Toyota in 1950. The Ford Archive in Dearborn, Michigan, contains an extraordinary gallery of pilgrims photographed with the master. They range from André Citroën, Citroën, Louis Renault, Renault, and Giovanni Agnelli, Fiat, to nameless Russians anxious to add mass production techniques to Lenin's formula of Soviets plus electrification equals communism. Lenin later amended this formula to Soviets plus Prussian Railway Administration plus American Industrial Organization equals socialism. A particularly striking photo, taken in 1921, captures Charlie Chaplin and Henry Ford in smiling mutual admiration alongside the Highland Park assembly line, at a time when Ford was still perceived as a miracle worker for the masses rather than the enemy of labor. William Morris, founder of the Oxford Motor Company and its subsidiary MG, and Herbert Austin, founder of the Austin Motor Company, were among these pilgrims. After Morris visited Highland Park in 1914, he returned to England determined immediately to copy mass production techniques in his own factory. But he didn't have an easy time of it. The war interrupted production, and a hand-powered assembly line was not in place until 1919. In this arrangement, cars rode on dollies on rails. However, the automobiles were pushed along to the next station by hand, so the whole line ran at the speed of the slowest worker. The assembly line was not powered until 1934, 20 years after Ford's first powered line in Detroit. Morris also found it difficult to divide labor to the extent Ford had. For example, his final assembly line consisted of 18 separate work tasks in 1919, while Ford's had 45 by 1914. Finally, Morris found it difficult to develop managers who were willing and able to operate a Ford-style mass production system. Quite incredibly, Morris continued to pay all his workers on a piece rate system until after World War II, despite the fact that all tasks were linked together in a continuous line. The workers' only concern, naturally, was to work as fast as they could to meet the day's quota and qualify for a bonus, then knock off. We can easily imagine the consequences of this system for the quality of the finished product. Morris stuck with piece rates because he could think of no other way to get his employees to work. His weakness in line management meant that he could run his plant only indirectly with the aid of shop stewards, who mediated between Morris and his workers on the work pace and piece rates. In short, while he was trying to create an exact copy of Highland Park, he was achieving instead an imitation of Ford at Trafford Park after the American managers left. In frustration, Morris gambled on what we would today call high-tech. In his engine plant, he proposed to totally automate the machining of engines, flywheels, and transmissions in order to eliminate most workers, both skilled and unskilled. Accounts of his experience, as we'll see, sound very much like the experiments of General Motors and Fiat with advanced automation in the 1980s, automation which was adopted out of similar frustrations. When Morris installed his equipment in 1925, he found that he could capture considerable savings as workers moved engine blocks and transmission cases along rails from machine to machine. Then each machine would work more or less automatically to complete a given task. Previously, the machines had been grouped by type, all milling machines in one area, grinding machines in another area, and lathes in a third area, and the parts had been carried one at a time on carts, a procedure that involved lifting and tugging at every machine. However, what the technology couldn't do was totally eliminate human intervention by automatically transferring the parts from one machine to the next. Indeed, this goal still exceeds the capabilities of technology. Herbert Austin had a very similar experience, except he never contemplated a high-tech leap as a way out. After visiting Highland Park in 1922, he returned to England determined to copy Ford's system. He succeeded halfway. Austin installed assembly lines, although these were not powered until 1928 or later, and divided work into small, unskilled tasks. But shop floor management was still very weak, so he stuck with piece rates as the best way of motivating his workers. An Austin worker years later told a BBC interviewer how this system worked in practice. "Well, you had so much time for doing a job. If you were on ordinary time, you'd get £2 a week, and then you'd have to go quicker and quicker to get more. So the assembly line would start at time and a quarter, and then it would go up to time and a half, or £3 a week. Management would speed it up as we got used to it, to double time. And when it got to double time, they'd stop. No more, no faster. And what we used to do, we'd have a real good go. We'd pick the bodies up and jump the pegs to move the cars along faster than the assembly line, and we'd make it up to double time and a half, which was about £5 a week, and this is a lot of money in them days." The idea of workers running down the line carrying automobiles faster than the conveyor seems comical today, and the system must have had horrendous consequences for the quality of the finished car. But Austin could see no other way to manage. As one of his senior managers argued in defense of the piecework pay system, "Some form of extra wage, the bonus, must be paid to a man if he's expected to work harder. The only alternative is to pay a high wage, similar to the Ford system, and insist on task achievement. The daily task system at fixed wages may perhaps be workable in American factories, but the necessary driving works policy would not be acceptable either to English labor or management. The English term for factory is works, so a driving works policy is simply machine pacing with standard day rates." The consequence of this hybrid system, now called the British system of mass production, was that British plants, including those of General Motors and Ford, never matched the productivity or quality of U.S. plants. Indeed, it was not until the financial crisis of 1980, 67 years after the introduction of the powered assembly line at Highland Park, that Rover, formerly British Leyland, the successor to the merged Austin and Morris companies, finally adopted standard hourly rates and explicitly set out to match the productivity of the Americans. British Leyland was nationalized in 1975. By 1979, it was hemorrhaging red ink, and a new management was installed with clear instructions to make the company efficient or close it down. By this time, of course, American-style mass production was already under siege from Japanese-inspired lean production. Mass production in continental Europe. The French, German, and Italian experience with mass production was a variation on the English theme, with the difference that the Americans had a harder time spreading their homegrown system through direct investment. Citroën, Renault, and Agnelli, to cite the three industrialists most taken with the mass production concept, struggled through the 1920s and 1930s to implement the idea in chaotic economic and political conditions. Their problems stemmed partly from